Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Lyre Van Cleef Stefanin. Van Cleef Stefanin is an assistant professor of English at Cornell University. Her work has appeared in many literary journals, including African American Review and Shenandoah. She is also author of two poetry collections. Her first, Black Swan, was winner of the 2001 Cave Canem Poetry Prize. Her most recent is called Open Interval and was a finalist for the 2009 National Book Award. Open Interval was published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. And welcome to the show, Lyre.
Thank you for having me.
Now, can you remember when did you first discover poetry and realize that it was going to be your major means of expression?
It's such a strange story because I don't remember not writing poetry. Mm-hmm. I've written poetry my whole life, from the time I was a little girl. And the earliest that I remember getting recognition for a poem that I had written was in elementary school. I wrote a poem about a space shuttle launch, and I gave it to my teacher, and she liked it and gave it to the principal, and they read it over the announcements, over the intercom.
Really?
One morning, yeah.
So did you find yourself interested in both poetry, writing, and science and math? Because we are going to start talking about your recent book, and it does touch on all those subjects.
The science and math is new. I was always someone who was interested in literature, and then as an undergraduate, I kind of wished sometimes that I had majored in geology. I like rocks, but I didn't do that. I took a geology class, but the science interest came much later, and poetry is a way for me to process science, because I don't think that I think like most people. It doesn't make sense to me unless I can kind of sieve it or filter it through the poems.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, okay, so let's talk about your recent collection of poetry, Open Interval. The title is a mathematical term. Tell us what the term means and what does it mean to you?
Simplified, an open interval is a continuous line. It doesn't contain its end points. And so the line is always approaching but never reaching the end point. And so I was interested in it because it gives you the sense of a bounded infinity. And when I started thinking about different things in my life, I started thinking about how many things were open intervals. The concept of God, for example, as an open interval, or the universe as an open interval, or identity, as comes up in this book, definitely as an open interval. And here I started thinking very much about the way in which, in terms of identity, you're not really this body that you're in, and you're not really your name, but your identity is kind of approaching those points, but not being really defined by them.
Yeah, I have always thought of identity as an open universe as well. And so your book really, really touched me in that way. Now, when you started writing the poems for this book, did you have in mind that it was going to intersect science, math, and identity? Or did those poems just start flowing out of you and suddenly became this collection?
I did have an idea that they were going to intersect. I think, again, it's kind of differently, I think, than some people that I've spoken to in terms of writing poems. I think in whole collections. And then I write the poems to go into the collection. So it's a kind of a macro view instead of the micro view. So I was thinking about that concept and then thinking about the different ways of approaching it.
Yeah, that is a different approach, it seems to me. Huh. You mentioned locating the self at the interval between name and body. And so what's between that? Did you discover that while you were writing this book?
Oh, my gosh. So many things, so many possibilities. I mean, one of the things that the book takes up is the concept of race, you know, and how, you know, that identity is located by, you know, people's visual interactions with your body, but it's so not that. So not that simple. And so that was something that I wanted to think about a lot. And the idea of community, you know, and how that works, and one's place in history. The whole thing, I kept coming back to intersections, crossroads, sites of intersection. And so there are all these references in the book to Jimi Hendrix. Suddenly I
noticed that,
realizing all of these intersections that I had with Jimi Hendrix, which seemed to really make sense in terms of thinking about the cosmos and the universe and all of that.
Well, I want to have you read one of the poems from Open Interval. It's called Black Hole. And can you tell us a little bit about it before you read it?
Sure. I was thinking about the black hole in critical analysis of African-American women's literature and everything was is a metaphor that gets used sometimes, and a complicated and a problematic one, I think, a lot. And also trying to think of myself as a poet and about the idea of form versus non-form. Mm. People describe me sometimes as an elliptical poet, and the idea of, that there are all these gaps left in the poems, and that the reader has to make these leaps of the mind with me. But in a way, I say that I'm also a neo-formalist poet. I'm a freak for a sonnet or a sestina or a villanelle or something like that. And so the tension between the freedom of being formlessness as freedom as opposed to form was something that I was thinking about, too. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes much sense.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea also of a star collapsing and the possibilities of what happens when a star collapses in terms of it opening up another whole
world.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what this poem's about.
Right. And the book is playing with my name so much, and my name is also the name of a type of star. And so I wanted to kind of have that idea in there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I'd love to hear you read this.
Black Hole. It's got an epigraph from C.K. Williamson. Poetry exists. Black hole. My darkness is not hell, but darkness. Darkness is naked and original. Is not darkness, but density. And every meaning of in is before description, compression, is word, quark, pion, mason, atom. Is fitting the self into flesh and aura. A star collapses from within. Itself there exists here, no escape. From slow curvature, winking delay, the crushing need for form.
Lovely. Lovely. You know, I always ask poets this. How much does come from the unconscious? I mean, you say you went out consciously to write in regard to the subject matter, mm-hmm. but you have to use your imagination for a lot of these poems, mm-hmm. especially about the universe and collapsing stars and black holes. Is it a dance between the two?
It is, and I try to step back a lot and encourage my students to step back a lot and look at the relationships that words form behind your back. As a poet, you're sitting there and you're thinking, I am writing this thing and I'm in control and I have something that I'm trying to convey or to say. But words have their own relationships. And so sometimes while you're writing one poem, they're back here, you know, conspiring behind you to write a completely different poem. And one of the things that I try to do and try to encourage my students to do is to pay attention, turn around and see what they're whispering about back there, those words, and see the connections that they're trying to make and follow them.
Uh-huh.
You know?
So you have a strong belief in the unconscious.
Uh-huh.
Words gathering behind you without you knowing, but giving you a little nudge.
Right. Did you ever see or hear that TED lecture that Elizabeth Gilbert gave, where she was talking about Ruth Stone, I think. She tells this story about a poet, I think it's Ruth Stone, being out in a garden or field outside of her house and hearing a poem like kind of coming across the field and running for the house to beat the poem to the house. And
wow.
Sometimes she just makes it in there just as the poem is going by and grabs the poem by the tail and pulls it back and gets it onto the page. It's really neat.
That's wonderful.
TED lecture.
Imagery.
Yeah, where it's kind of like there's sense in which, okay, you're in some control of things, and then there's this sense in which you're not in control of anything.
Exactly. Now, you do use the dash and the colon in many of your poems.
Mm-hmm.
What does that symbolize for you? Is it communicating sound, silence, letting people fill in the blanks?
I was indicating, okay, you have those dashes, and so it suggests this continuation of thought or this like kind of broken off thought that's going to be picked up later. And then you have these colons that are indicating like, oh, I'm going to explain something or expound on something or give you a further definition or something like that. But then there's also the way that they look on the page. I was thinking about words and, like I said, their own relationships. And so I was trying to make chemical bonds. You know how they teach you when you're in school to draw H2O, and you have the you have the two H's and the O's, and they've got those dashes between them and things like that. And so I wanted that sense of chemical bonds between them. The symbols also, they make little pictures that are interesting, like little plunger things that you can make up, pick up a word with or something. I really wanted the reader to interact with those in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter which way, right? I mean, it's up for grabs.
In some of the poems, it's clearer. Like, for example, in the poem, R.R. Lyrae Matter, the way that husband is on the page, the dashes and colons are set up such that husband is being held there on the line, but it's being held, it's kind of like it's being held by an energy field. You know what I mean? You'd have to look at it on the page. Like the husband is suspended and it's kind of vibrating in that space.
That's really interesting.
Like that's the thing in the absence. That's the word in the absence.
Uh-huh. So it almost brings in music as well as, you know, the vibration, you say. That's really fascinating. Now, I heard you talking at one of your readings about how you saw a truck full of dead deer, and then that you wanted to go see the Body Works exhibit, but all this stuff freaked you out. But your poet voice told you had to go look at these things.
Yes.
Tell us about that poet voice that is making you face.
That voice really irritates me when I tell that story. My colleague Ken McLean, who is like such a fantastic,
wonderful man,
poet and essayist, and just a generally fantastic person.
Yeah, he's been on the show.
Yeah, he laughs at me about that voice, because when I saw that truck full of the dead deer, my initial impulse is to turn away, of revulsion, of to not look at that. And there's a voice in me that says, no, you look at everything.
Mm-hmm.
The art of attention, like part of the poet's
mandate,
art of attention. You pay attention to that. You look at that and see what that is. That may be something later that's going to teach you something.
Yeah.
And so I felt that way about the Body Worlds exhibit, because corpses with their skin off, wow, that's a lot to deal with.
Into the depths. And you did write a poem about it for this current collection. It's called Body Works 2, In Case. And I do want you to read from that. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about how you were feeling?
Yes. Well, one of the things that's so interesting about it is I felt compelled to go and see the exhibit, but then also that sense of revulsion about it also. And I don't know, I started thinking about how that had to do with race, you know, in terms of the body approaching, identity approaching the body and approaching your name. And here are these bodies that are now stripped of their names, and then they're stripped of their skin also. Mm-hmm. And so then that kind of identifying factor is taken away. And also about what is natural and unnatural. I like kind of juxtapose it against the scenery here in Ithaca, you know, in the poem. And so, like, is this what's natural? Is this what's unnatural? The body is supposed to be natural. And the ways in which, when I was going through the exhibit, it's set up in a way that's so seductive. You go in there, or I went in there thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to be so disgusted by this. And then at first I was completely drawn in. Like, this is really fascinating to have this opportunity to look. Until you start thinking about things like, who are these people? And then it's a problem.
Oh, well, I'd love to hear you read the poem about this.
Body Worlds 2, In Case. I am preparing myself, preparing to lose race. I don't know what I will do without it. This is the most unromantic way. I know how to get into the between, how to exceed, divorce, erasure, corpses, diligently labeled plastinate. Someone skinned in laws, an exhibition sold out in advance. I haven't even seen it, and I'm freaked. I keep reeling Kennedy's skull flap, too pink, shot back, the reflexed hands to the throat. I'm sitting in my element at the edge of Cayuga Lake. It's spring. Why peel it back away? Look, here at my beautiful foot. My windshield's clean. I rest my leg against the heating vents, my long brown foot foregrounded on the dash before the sky's excellent blue clear April, my silver-painted pedicure. Why move beyond these slender bark brown silver-tipped toes? What's under my skin is ugly meat, sinew. Who is asking and why ruin the view out the window? Willows, branches, yellow going green, push left of their shadow-blacked trunks by wind. Loose and graceful like the arms of ballerinas. Then the breeze stiffens, the skinny strands straighten, extend like stick slim legs, arabesque, on point. Look, no one wants the dead in toe shoes, but that's keeping it real, keeping even the empty body on display. The real threat of the exhibition of seeing the one who's been posed holding his own, split skin open like a flasher by its flayed edges.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lyra Van Cleef Stefan, and we're talking about her recent book of poetry, Open Interval. Now, that poem you just read, there's a lot in your book about how you tell the story of how experiences actually lead to change. Did this experience of just writing this book change you in any way?
I think that it did, and I think that I'm still trying to process that in the new book. I'm working on a new book of poems called The Coal Tar Colors, again, with that same, the macro is there ahead of time, and I'm trying to write poems that are going with what I'm thinking about. But the crazy thing about it is everything is coming from all of these different directions, and I don't know how they hold together. And I'm part of the thing that I have to do is experience things to reveal to me how they hold together. So in The Coal Tar Colors, there's the idea of Audre Lorde said, "I is the total black being spoken from the earth's inside," at the beginning of her poem, Coal. And so there's that idea. And then there's this idea of race again, but in different ways, the idea of being where one's not supposed to be, which gets taken up in here, but it's going to really get expanded, I think, in The Coal Tar Colors. I graduated from Washington and Lee University in 1989. They had just graduated their first class of women. And so it was still a place in which women were very much not necessarily welcomed and kind of looked at askance. And then it's Washington and Lee. So in terms of race and the Civil War, Robert E. Lee is buried there. He and all of his kinfolk are buried. And then his horse, Traveler, is buried behind the chapel. And so that horse keeps running through my head. And my interactions with that horse are things that I'm thinking about. And also the idea of Appalachia. I have an adoptive Appalachian family. But Appalachia is posited in the American imagination as the site where there is no blackness, save for the coal beneath the ground.
Ah.
And so that's in there. And so somehow that's being tied with Lee and the horses, and then with banjos. I'm learning how to play the banjo. And so it's all of this different stuff that I don't know how to pull together. And so one of the ways through experience I try to figure out how to pull it together, which is also going to sound bizarre, is I go to New York and look at the Kandinsky exhibit that's at the Guggenheim.
That makes sense to me.
And Kandinsky's Blue Rider. And look at those paintings with those horses and look at what he's doing with color and what he's saying about color and see how that is helping to pull all of those things together. Or I go and look at the Yinkashonabare exhibit that was at the Brooklyn Museum mm-hmm. and look at how he's playing with these notions of identity, with the way that these pieces are set up, with these 19th century costumes made with this Dutch wax cotton that you associate with Africa, you know, and things like that.
So you start getting thoughts in your head, and then you go have the experiences to enrich them.
Yes.
And then you will eventually write.
Yes. The experiences somehow become the glue that holds them together. It's funny, glue is the thing that comes to my head right now, because I also become obsessed with words themselves as the thing that's going to pull them together. And the word that's obsessing me right now is the word mordant. The book is The Coal Tar Colors, and I'm thinking about the way in which artificial colors are made. Mordant is the thing that makes the color stick to the fabric, but it's also can be used to describe a person's wit or somebody's being very caustic or something.
Uh-huh.
And then there's another word they also call mordant red liquor.
Wow. You take a microscope to these things, don't you?
Yes.
That's amazing. That really is quite amazing.
I don't think linearly at
mm-hmm.
all.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Well, that's how you go into these little, you know, minute worlds and tell us where you've been in so many ways. But before we do run out of time, I often ask creative writers this. Do you feel like it's your responsibility to write about politics or to put politics into your work, or do you think creative writers should stay away from political dialogue?
I do. I believe that the personal is political.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, one of the things that's in this book is a poem for Amadou Diallo.
Yes.
And the thing that's so heartbreaking about that story is that as he's being shot, the thing that he's doing is reaching for his body is not enough to prove that he belongs where he is,
mm-hmm.
that this is who I am and I belong where I am. And so he's reaching for his ID.
I remember the case. I remember the story.
To show the police officer, see, this is me. So he's reaching for this thing that's outside of his, because your body's not enough, mm-hmm. to say, see, I belong here because this is me.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
that, in terms of identity and everything, I just thought, wow. That definitely, I felt, went along with everything else that was going on in this collection.
Yeah. So politics isn't something you would shy away from. I do have some people say that it should be separate.
Mm.
Creativity is supposed to be something that gives people joy, and you know, other people think art is also to provoke and to make people think.
Right, and I mean, the Amadou Diallo poem and the Body World poems, I think, are so tied to each other in terms of, well, then what happens if, you know, this person is stripped of their name and of their identity and all of that? Or the thing that makes Amadou Diallo a person who is known now is his absence. And so in that poem, the thing that's so sad to me is we as a society have said to his mother, your son's presence in his body was not enough. It is his absence that makes him important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It fills in the blanks almost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, interspersed in your book are sonnets. We've talked about this.
Yes.
Your name, Lyre, is a star. To tell us more about that, and I will ask you to read R.R. Lyre Timepiece.
Yes. R.R. Lyre stars are pulsating variable stars. They brighten and dim as they expand and contract, and they share a similar absolute luminosity, and so they're called standard candles. Astronomers use them for calculating distances.
Mm.
And so I thought that was really interesting, and I thought that the RR designation...
Which means what?
It's just part of, you know, as they're counting down the stars, you know, they start with A or whatever.
So it's just two letters.
Ah. It just happened to be RR, but that RR makes me think of blues and crossroads, you know, railroad crossings. X marks the spot. Here is that site of intersection, you know, where that's all happening. So, yeah.
And what, were you named after this star?
No.
So it's just a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
You tapped into it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, well, I'd love to hear a timepiece.
R.R. Lyre, timepiece. The sun confronts me, soloing its light. The sky reclaimed by ordinary morning. A six-piece band of birds begins its tuning, leaching the east of gray, what's left of night. Elided into day, a blue too bright for me, my name, an evening illusion. In Magellanic clouds flickers its fusion throughout galactic epochs. When it's late, the concert hall marquees of heaven lit with lyrae pulsate, flashing in the halos, the ages of a universe in neon, the oldest star's birth date. And some have taught in ancient pinks, infinite burning yellows, an infant sun, the essence of an aeon.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Library, we only have a couple minutes left. I wanted to ask you about how you inspire your students. I know you're an assistant professor of writing.
Yes.
How do you tell people to approach writing? And is there a unique way?
It's really funny. I push my students. I'm really hard on my students in terms of trying to get them to be in service to the poem. And to really, really pay attention to the poem and about the process of revision. And that revision is not editing. Mm. It is a complete re-envisioning of the poem. I don't write line edits or comments on my students' work. I prefer to have conversations with them about, you know, where they're trying to get in the poem and what the, you know, the words are doing behind their back and how that's all working, so that they don't feel as though, oh, she said this line was good and this word needs to be changed and I changed this comma, and yeah, I'll hand that back in and say, yay, the poem is revised. And I say, when your poem is taken for publication or whatever, they'll give you an editor. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be an editor right now, you know, vision. And the art of attention is kind of where it's at in terms of what you're trying to do right now. I encourage them to look into the meanings of words that have disappeared. I am a freak about the OED, obsessively, you know, encouraging them to look at the OED and look at what does this word actually mean that you're using, not just the surface initial meaning, but what are the other meanings that are underneath there, that are underpinning this word? So
you're trying to get your students to dig deeper.
Yes,
get away from the surface.
And very much so.
That sounds like great advice. Anything else you're working on besides a new book of poetry? I heard that you were writing a novel about skydiving.
Yes, who told you that? Oh,
I find information from all kinds of places, just
yes,
like you do.
That's really funny. I have no idea really how to write a novel, but I'm trying to write a novel. I grew up on a drop zone, not literally grew up, but I spent a lot of time there in my teenage years at Skydive DeLand. And so, yeah, trying to write a novel based on some of those experiences.
Well, we hope it happens. Lyrae Van Cleef Stefanen, thank you so much for joining us, and do go out and buy Open Interval. It's an absolutely wonderful and magical book of poetry. Thank you, Lyrae, for being with us.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.